offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the pleasure of joining you live from our studios at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center. It's a beautiful Thursday, and we are here to resume this Triune Pilgrimage. We are also here to begin a new chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. We have completed 7 chapters. I more or less completed the summary of the 7th chapter last week. Just a small bit is remaining. We'll do that. But we are going to start the 8th chapter. Another small chapter, but certainly a chapter that is packed with a lot of profound content and profound words and concepts, which with Swami's grace, hopefully we'll be able to go through little by little. We'll complete the summary of the 7 chapters, as I said, and it has been separated chapter-wise, pretty much what Krishna tells in the 8th chapter is based on these 3 shlokas in the end of the 7th chapter, which I'll be summarizing now. The last 3 verses, 28, 29 and 30 of the 7th chapter, Krishna goes back to describing those that are in the process of or have overcome the delusion, right? Before this, he spoke about those that are already deluded and are unable to see God's true nature, and that's why they seek other benefits from God when they come and worship Him. Before that portion, he spoke briefly about the jnani, and of course, preceding that, he spoke about the 4 categories of people who worship the Lord, the arthi, artharthi, jignyasu, and the jnani. In the 28th verse, Krishna says that the one whose sins have gradually reduced and have come to an end and have become free from the grip of likes and dislikes worships me with steadfastness or steadiness. Bhajante mam dhridavrataha. So as we've been seeing, Krishna has been making it very clear that this is not about one action, one good action or one bad action. This is about refining one's nature over many lifetimes. And even when he spoke of dushkritinaha, those who have fallen into bad ways, he was making a reference to those who over many, many lifetimes have turned towards the wrong path, right? And similarly, when he's talking about the jnani, he is referring to those sukritinaha who have turned to the Lord and whose karmic balance, so to say, has come to a minimal and then eventually gets altogether sublimated, and that's how they come to become dridavitahas, those who have steady focus on the Lord. The 29th verse, Krishna puts the same thing in a slightly different manner. For liberation from old age and death, jara marana mokshaya, those who strive for this jara marana mokshaya, taking refuge in me, realize the whole knowledge of the Brahman, the self, and all karma. That's the statement that Krishna makes in the 29th verse. These are all concepts which Krishna will be explaining in the chapter to follow, and we will be coming to them shortly. Whatever he said, that whoever has been striving to overcome old age and death will eventually, and they are trying to overcome this by taking refuge in me. That's what is important. That's what defines a devotee, right? For whom the path is the Lord, the destination also is the Lord, is referred to as a devotee, right? So Krishna is saying those who have taken to this path, they will come to know Brahman, the self, and karma in its entirety. So these concepts will be discussed further. When we were doing the chapter, we discussed an important import of the statement, striving after taking refuge in the Lord. What does that mean? We often think of surrender as the last thing that we do, right? But here Krishna is making it very clear that surrender itself is a process. Surrender itself is a commitment which is followed by certain sets of actions. And we discussed then that it is about letting Swami become the bigger influence in our life, because we are constantly influenced by everything that is happening around us. that we hear from others around us, that we read, that we see. But the whole idea of taking refuge in the Lord and then striving literally means that you make the Lord, the words of the scriptures, as the greatest influence in your life, as those that guide your actions and words. And when Krishna says freedom from death and old age, we had seen how this is an inbuilt craving that is there in every jiva. This is not like any other raga and dvesha that we speak of. It is not some kind of a frivolous dislike for old age and the effects old age has on our appearance, or a very childish fear of death that is born of attachment alone. We are talking about a more fundamental fear. Again, we will discuss this also a little bit more today, because Arjuna is going to ask for further clarifications and we'll go into that. But in the case of the jnani, when we're talking about overcoming old age and the fear of death, the liberation that Krishna is speaking about is not attained for the body, but is attained in spite of the body, or rather is established by the knowledge that one is not the body, but one is the Atma that can never age or never die, right? That shift in understanding is what happens in the case of a jnani. Krishna also makes a statement that such people come to know Adhyatma and Karma in its entirety, right? As we just saw. This, of course, as I said, we will be dwelling further in the 8th chapter. Krishna ends that chapter by saying in the 30th verse, those who know me with Adibhuta, pertaining to the elements, Adidaiva, pertaining to the gods, and Adiyajna, pertaining to the sacrifices, know me even at the time of death, steadfast in mind. These three terms, Adhyatma, which you mentioned in the previous, there are four terms actually, Adhyatma, which he mentioned in the previous verse, Brahman and Karma were other two words that he mentioned. They will all be explained in the next chapter to come. But in this shloka and the previous one, the idea that Krishna is reiterating is that the final understanding is to recognize the Lord as being present in all aspects of creation, right? When he says Adidaiva, Adibhuta and Adi Atma, we'll see that. These are all different aspects of creation, different ways at which you look at how creation has come to be. So the idea that is being conveyed is the Lord is present in all these aspects and more. And finally, he of course says that this idea will remain even at the time of death, meaning that knowledge becomes a part of one's nature. It is no more something that has to be remembered. It has become internalized. It has become part of one's making or one's being itself. So this was the 7th chapter, and with that we'll conclude the summary of the chapter. I thought I'll just give you a reading suggestion if some of you are interested, because that 7th chapter is very profound. It speaks about how we have to interact with Prakriti, how we are supposed to worship and adore the Lord through nature and all of that. There is one chapter in Swami's Sandeha Nivarani, another Vahini written by Swami. The 3rd chapter of Sandeha Nivarani, the topic of the title of which is the external world, the internal world and Bhagwan. It's a very beautiful chapter. Whatever we went through in this particular chapter of Bhagavad Gita has been elucidated beautifully through a conversation. Those of you who are familiar with Sandeha Nivarani will know that Swami has written it in the form of a conversation between Swami and a devotee. So this entire concept that we have gone through is beautifully elucidated through such conversations in that particular chapter. So if any of you are interested, you can go and read that. Much of it will be a revision of what we've done here. And of course, I'm sure that when you read it from Swami's words directly, there will be better insights and better understandings that will come forth from within too. So that is the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and we will proceed now with prayers to Swami to the 8th chapter. In a way, Swami connects this last portion of the 7th chapter to what follows in the 8th in a very unique way, and I thought We will start the discussion on the 8th chapter with what Swami has written in Gita Vahini in a manner of connecting these two chapters together. As we just saw in the summary of the last few shlokas, Krishna made a statement that those who strive for liberation from old age and death, jara and marana. The reference to this craving is actually to, if you really look at it, all fears and griefs that are within. It is only represented by these two terms of old age and death, jara and marana. Because death and old age represent, at least in my own understanding of having gone through what Swami says, two broad ways by which we bring sorrow into our life, right? It is not merely death and decay of this body. We become sorrowful when something that we like is taken away from us, or when the status quo that is favorable to us is being disturbed. I'm in a comfortable, easygoing, and everything is going smooth in my life. And if some event happens that disrupts this favorable status quo, then I get disturbed and I get unhappy, right? Or something that I like is taken away from me. It could be an object, it could be a person, it could be an ambition, it could be a dream. So sorrow comes into our life in two ways: when something is taken away or something that we like is undergoing a change. And I think these two are represented symbolically by death and old age in what Krishna is saying here. And a person who is trying to liberate oneself from these two is actually looking for a way out of grief in general, right? Otherwise, it will look like, when you read this verse, that Krishna is trying to give some, you know, beauty tip to overcome old age, or means by which you can remain alive forever. Something which, you know, if you go through our epics, all the asuras always crave for, that immortality of the body. But Krishna is not conveying that. Krishna is addressing the anxiety that is inherent in human life, right? When something is taken away, when what we like is not happening, or what we like is being changed. That's why Swami writes in Gita Vahini in this manner, that portion where I said Swami connects these two chapters. Swami says, and I quote, and these are in the words of Krishna. So Swami writes, Arjuna, everyone is anxious to avoid old age and death. That is human nature. But of what avail is mere anxiety? One's conduct and behavior should be in accordance with one's objective. If one has sincere yearning, and if one places full trust in and faithfully surrenders to the Lord, the fog of grief will be dispersed by the rays of His grace. If, on the other hand, one places trust on the objects of this world, the consequent grief will never end, nor can it be ended by any other than the Lord. Serve the master of delusion, the designer of all this dreamland, rather than the dream itself. How can attachment to delusion yield anything but disappointment? How can joy be won by such pursuits? If joy is not won and grief avoided, how can liberation be achieved? Krishna said. End of quote. So in a way, Swami is summarizing the essence of this whole chapter in that small passage. Why do we struggle from morning to evening? Because we want to avoid grief. We want to be happy. That is why we perform karma. And we perform karma relentlessly. And as Krishna explained, it is for the same reason that we turn to God too. But there's a little flaw in our approach, right? When we turn to God and when we seek objects of the world, we don't seek from God to get over our grief, but we decide what will make us happy, and then we turn to God and ask for those things. And as Krishna explained, the nature of the things themselves is that they perish, they are ephemeral. So the relief that we get by getting those things as blessings from God or grace from God, even though they are granted by God himself, the nature of that gift becomes temporary. Right? So that is what Swami had explained in that passage that I read out. Swami said that you seek things from the world is a delusion, and when you get something that is from this dream world, is also made of that same dream stuff, and that cannot give you happiness, and it will only lead to disappointment. So the way out is not to seek from God objects that we think will make us happy and keep us cheerful, but to take refuge in God himself. But the last statement that Krishna makes, as written by Swami in Gita Vahini, causes a little concern and confusion for Arjuna. Krishna had said, if joy is not won and grief is avoided, how can liberation be achieved? Right? That was the statement that Swami makes there. I'm going to God to overcome grief. But here Krishna is saying the best way to overcome grief is to take refuge in him. And then he is saying, if you have not won over grief, you cannot attain me. You cannot attain liberation. Right? There is a paradox there. We are coming to the Lord to overcome grief. But Swami is saying that if you have not won over grief, you cannot attain me. So we seem to be in what is famously alluded to as the catch 22, neither here, neither there. So Swami writes, and this is as Arjuna's question, and I quote, Krishna, can't such people attain you? You say that grief must be conquered before one can attain you. Well, what is the origin of that grief? How is it to be tackled? How does it arise? How can one try to overcome it without knowing its origin and cause of development? Please tell me how this grief arises in the human mind. Krishna replies, the source of all types of sorrow is ignorance. You might now ask me what the source of ignorance is. I shall tell you. It is the identification with the body, the delusion that you are the body. This can be removed only by the acquisition of right knowledge. To remove darkness, light is needed. You cannot frighten darkness away or make it yield by prayer or petition or protest. Unless light is on, darkness will not disappear, howsoever you may try. So too, ignorance will not disappear by merely wishing for its disappearance. Once you understand the nature and ramifications of this trait, this ignorance, the truth will be laid bare and grief will vanish. When ignorance goes, grief goes too. So attach yourself to me, earn the light of true knowledge, and tread the path of no grief, said Krishna. End of quote. Why is the best category of devotee called jnani? In the previous chapter, when we were going through the categorization, the highest of devotees is referred to as jnani. The reason being what Krishna said in that passage that I read out. The jnani devotee has overcome all grief through jnana, through the knowledge that he or she is not the body, right? This process or quest of trying to understand one's own nature and the nature of God is very, very closely related. We would have heard Swami speak of the four stages a devotee goes through, right, in her or his relationship with God. You must have heard these words before. Salokyam, Samipyam, Sarupyam, and Sayujyam. I will not go into each one of them. I will speak of just the last two stages, Sarupyam and Sayujyam. Sayujyam is the stage where the devotee merges with the Lord. It is also called Sayujya Mukti, right? Where the devotee's identity completely dissolves in that of the Lord. But the stage before that is referred to as Sarupyam. And in general translation, that means likeness of rupa or form, or becoming identical in form to the Lord. And Swami would often give the example of Bharata. When Rama was away in the forest, Bharata locked himself up in Nandigrama and constantly contemplated on Rama. So much so that finally when Rama returned and Bharata also came out of his self-imposed quarantine, if I could say that. And when both Bharata and Rama come before the citizens, they're not able to differentiate between who is Bharata and who is Rama, because Bharata has become so much like Rama in appearance because of his constant contemplation on Rama. Well, this was a case where this was practically possible to make out, right? Because God was there in a form and the devotee also starts tending towards that form, and then you can say, okay, this is Sarupya Bhakti. But truly speaking, this step, which is referred to as Sarupyam, I think is a little more deeper than this. And it is, Bharata's contemplation was not merely physical, right? He had become like Rama, but if you see truly, it was not merely in appearance. He had become like Rama in nature, right? That is the unsaid part of that description. If you see our relationship with Swami, we do two things simultaneously. One is, we try to perfect our own nature based on what Swami expects of us. And we are also trying to better understand Swami's nature. A devotee does both of these things, and both of these things are equally important. I'm not saying that Swami can be understood or we should make an attempt to understand Swami. Whether we make or not, our comprehension of what Swami expects and who Swami is, what is Swami's personality, is constantly undergoing a change, even as our own personality is undergoing a transformation, right? So that's typically what a devotee is supposed to do. The devotee is supposed to analyze one's own nature and change it, and also analyze what Swami is all about. So in the first part of the journey, I am trying to better understand my own nature by becoming a better version of myself. So my idea of my real form is undergoing a transformation. And in the second part of it, my idea of what is Swami's true form and nature is also undergoing a change. So in my idea, Sarupyam is that stage where we start seeing similarity between these two ideas. My idea of who I am and my idea of who he is. When these two start coming closer and closer, that is what I feel is referred to as Samipyam, and eventually comes to a point where you start finding similarities between this idea of I and this idea of he. And Sayujyam is not likely to start until this identical identity is to an extent acknowledged. And the Sayujyam, as the word itself suggests, comes from the root yuj, just like yoga. Yuj means to connect or to yoke. So as my idea of my true form and my idea of his true form become more and more true, they come closer and closer together, and at one point they are so identical that communion becomes so naturally possible. And when the union becomes irreversible, I think it is referred to as Sayujyam, oneness. In this chapter, Krishna is going to go deeper into the nature of divine, right? As we have seen, even in the previous chapter, it is referred to as a chapter which is where the Tat aspect of Tattvamasi, the Mahavakya, is described. And here also is going to be the same case, where Krishna is going to describe the idea of who God is. So these two things simultaneously will happen when you're talking about karma yoga, when you're talking about performing swadharma, moral dilemmas, discrimination. All of that is a means by which I'm perfecting the idea of myself. But this chapter and the chapters that follow, or for that matter, the scriptures which speak about the nature of Brahman, they're all for us to reflect upon and meditate upon, so that our idea of who God is also undergoes this transformation that is very necessary. So that is why this chapter, where Krishna speaks about the nature of the divine, is referred to as Akshara Parabrahma Yoga. Some refer to it as Akshara Brahma Yoga also, but Swami calls it Akshara Parabrahma Yoga. We'll stick to that. And Akshara Parabrahma Yoga for a specific reason, which we'll come to shortly. So what is this chapter about? Krishna stopped the previous chapter talking about death and decay, right? Krishna means to kshara. The word kshara here, the chapter's name is Akshara Brahma Yoga. The word kshara means to decay or to be destroyed. So akshara means that which is indestructible or immutable. So Akshara Parabrahma Yoga is the study of this supreme divinity that is beyond death and decay. And this explanation is connected to the last statement that Krishna made in the previous chapter. Those who know me as one with the Adhibhuta, Adhidaiva and Adhiyajna know me even at the time of death, steadfast in mind. So not only is Krishna going to speak of the Akshara Parabrahman, but how it is Adhibhuta, Adhidaiva and Adhiyajna also. And how knowing God in this manner will lead you to think of Him in the last moments of one's life. But for that, we must first understand these terminologies that Krishna has used. What is this Adhiyajna and Adhidaiva and Adhibhuta and all of that? What do they connote? And how is that related to this Akshara Parabrahman that Krishna is going to speak about? And thankfully for us, Arjuna is asking the question to Krishna and telling him, please wait, explain these terms for me before you go any further. And that is how the 8th chapter begins, with a question that Arjuna is asking, seeking clarification from Krishna. So we'll start the 8th chapter, we'll listen to the first verse, the question that Arjuna asks in the words, in the recitation of Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it in his voice. As always, he's been kind enough to record this chapter also for us. So we'll listen to the verse. I'll give you a very brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Arjuna uvacha kim tad brahma kim adhyatmam kim karma purushottama adhibhutam cha kim proktam adhidaivam kim uchyate.
Arjuna asked, what is that Brahman? What is termed Adhyatma? What is karma? O Purushottama, what is stated to be Adhibhuta? What is called Adhidaiva? So this is Arjuna's question on the basis of what Krishna is, on the basis of which Krishna is going to give this entire discourse in this chapter. So Arjuna asks about the various terms that Krishna mentioned in the last two verses of the previous chapter. He says, kim tat brahma? What is that Brahman? Kim adhyatman? What is adhyatma? Or what is that which belongs to the self? Kim karma? What is karma? Remember, Krishna had said, te brahma tat viduhu kritsnam adhyatmam karma cha akhilam. They know in entirety Brahman, Adhyatma and all karma, right? That's why this first line Arjuna is asking about all those three things that Krishna had mentioned in that shloka. Kim tat brahma, kim adhyatmam, kim karma purushottama. In the next line of that verse, Krishna, Arjuna says, adhibhutam cha kim proktam. What is spoken of as adhibhutam? Adhidaivam kim uchyate? What is spoken of as adhidaiva? We'll probably go to the next verse also, the second verse, because it's a continuation of what Arjuna is asking. We'll listen to that also, and we'll probably try to look at it from Arjuna's point of view. Why is he asking some of these questions? What is there any other specific reason for that? But first we'll listen to the second verse where Arjuna continues this question, and then we will discuss about that.
Adhiyajñah katham kotra dehesmin madhusudana prayanakale cha katham nyeyosi niyatatmabhihi.
How and who is that Adhiyajna here in this body, O Madhusudana? And at the time of death, how are you known by those whose minds are steady? So that's the second verse. In this verse, Arjuna asks about the term Adhiyajna and also the other point that Krishna made about what happens at the time of death. But he asks about Adhiyajna in a more specific way. He asks, Adhiyajna katham, how, kaha, who, atra dehe asmin Madhusudana. In this body, O Madhusudana, who and how is that which is referred to as Adhiyajna to be recognized? Right? That is the question that he asks. He doesn't simply ask what is Adhiyajna. He is asking, how do I know what and who that is in this body? And then he asks, prayana kale cha, and at the time of death, katham nyeyah asi, how are you knowable? Niyatatma bhi, by the self-controlled or the one who is focused. Niyatatma bhi, niyata means to be focused or to be steady in one thing, right? So firstly, Arjuna hints that he is aware that whatever is being spoken of as Adhibhuta, Adhiyajna and so on are represented within this human personality itself, right? That is why he asks, how do I recognize them in this body? So that is the first acknowledgement that Arjuna is making, or the revelation that he understands that much, that these are not things that are in the space. And secondly, he expresses this doubt. Is it really possible to hold on to this knowledge at the time of death? Can we really have control over our thoughts in the last moments of our lives? Who knows? Arjuna might have even thought he's in the battlefield. Krishna is teaching him such profound wisdom. Tomorrow, if I take part in the battle and I'm going to die, is it possible that I will remember this discourse that Krishna is giving? That is what we generally tend to do, isn't it? When somebody is coming and giving us a talk or a discourse, we immediately try to put ourselves in that place, or try to take that what is being spoken and look at our lives juxtaposed to what is being said, right? So, quite possible that that must have been Arjuna's view also. Because when Krishna is talking about at the time of death, if Arjuna was to die in the battle, he is likely to think about Draupadi, he is likely to think about Subhadra, maybe his mother Kunti, or maybe his son Abhimanyu, or the other Pandavas. Is he really likely to think about Brahman, Karma, Adhyatma and Adhidaiva? Is that really possible? And also the way Krishna is saying, what you think of the last moments seems so significant, right? Because otherwise Krishna will not make a reference to that, saying that you will remember this even at the time of your last moments. So the thoughts that come to us in those last moments somehow seem to be related to the way we lead our lives, right? It is not something random. Imagine I'm sitting in a movie theater and I'm seeing, I don't know how the movie theaters project these days, but in the good old days they used to have these reels and the light being projected through those reels onto a wall And that's how we would see the movie, right? Imagine a movie is being projected like that and suddenly there's a power cut. Nobody can tell that which frame is going to be the last frame, isn't it? In the same manner, we are living through life and it seems like the last thought that I would have before I leave this body could be a very random one. Can that be manipulated? Can I clearly say that this should be the last thought when I leave this body? Is that really possible? From what Krishna is saying, it seems like that is possible. Otherwise, Krishna will not make a reference to that. Or you could probably tell that for people who lead an entire life, right? Let's say somebody who dies of old age, led a complete life, and then eventually they fall sick and slowly they pass away. In such lives, also maybe you can think of a possibility like this. But what about the case of someone like Arjuna, a warrior, right? A warrior's life always has this knife hanging on their head. Akala mrityu, or premature death, is always a possibility in the life of a warrior. It is not like those who lead a full life and then die. So is there a possibility that even in the life of a warrior, for whom death might come any time, the last thoughts can be fixed? You can say for sure that this is the last thought, it'll be in my mind. So maybe that is the reason why Arjuna is specifically asking this question. That can these thoughts really be remembered in the last moments of one's life? So these are the different questions that Arjuna asks. In the next few verses, Krishna is going to answer each one of them. And then the rest of the chapter, he's going to go on to elaborate the answers that he gives to. So we'll truly begin the chapter by listening to the first answer that Krishna gives. The third verse is where Krishna begins to give the answers. It's a very profound verse, this verse itself. We will see how much we are able to cover and then we'll take it on from there. So we'll first listen to the shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss as much as we can.
Shri Bhagavanuvacha Aksharam Brahma Paramam Swabhavodhyatma Muchyate Bhuta Bhavodbhavakaro Visargah Karma Sannitaha.
The Blessed Lord said, Brahman is the imperishable supreme. Its essential nature is called self-knowledge or adhyatma. The offerings which causes existence and manifestation of beings and which also sustains them is called karma or action. So this is the first reply that Krishna gives. So Krishna begins his discourse on these topics from this point. Before we go into what Krishna is saying, maybe just a few words about the historical context of what Krishna is saying. And I think it can be mentioned here because many of the scholars who go through the Gita, especially historian scholars, if I could use that term, what they say about this particular discourse, and there is a significance to that. Today when we speak about spirituality or Vedanta, we invariably refer to Advaita Vedanta, right? And Advaita Vedanta is only one section of Vedanta where it believes that there is one and there is no other, that there is only one Brahman and that Brahman and the Atman within the Jiva, within the individual, is one and the same. As put by Adi Shankara in a very crisp statement, Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya Jivo Brahmaiva Napara. Only Brahman is real, this entire world is an illusion, and the Jiva or individual soul and the Brahman are Napara, not distinct. over the years and over the many centuries, we have come to accept this view, right? Thanks to gurus like Adi Shankara himself, who have worked very hard to pass on this idea and through their intellectual abilities have very convincingly passed on this idea. And you know, that is one of the ways by which the philosophies grew, right? Swami has also spoken about it, the extensive debates that used to happen through between scholars who profess these various ideologies. So in that manner, Advaita Vedanta has been passed on, and today when we say Vedanta, we think that this alone is Vedanta, but it is not so. What is really Vedanta? It is the constant, it is something that is got as a result of constant churning of the Vedas. And these have led to certain deeper conclusions about what is conveyed in these Vedas. And that is referred to as Vedanta, the culmination of the Vedas, right? I won't go into the entire thing, but the Vedanta section is referred to as Aranyakas, right? When the Vedas were taken by these sages who dedicated themselves to the study of the Vedas, they go away to the forests, which are referred to as Aranyas, and through deep contemplation, they come up with the Upanishads, right? And which is referred to as Vedanta. So Vedanta itself means somebody has given their time and energy and mind space to these truths that are revealed in the Vedas, and they have clarified it over this process of inquiry and rumination. And this churning or very deep inquiry has led to many schools of Vedanta, of which Advaita Vedanta is one of them. There is Dvaita, there is Vishishta Dvaita, and there are a couple of more. And these Vedantic schools themselves have their sources in the darshanas or schools of philosophy of Sanatan Dharma, right? Even before concluding that this is what the Vedas say, there are some people who have an approach, right? We all have philosophies. Those philosophies do not necessarily come out of deep thinking, right? We just believe in one philosophy and then we go on with life, especially youngsters of these days. There is no deep thinking into that. We just fancy a philosophy, all of us. I mean, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. We just fancy one kind of philosophy of life and we take it and we lead our life by that, right? So there are these darshanas, and I'm not speaking of these darshanas in a very flippant manner in that, but I'm just saying that even before the truth is concluded upon, there is a certain approach that people take. And these in Sanatan Dharma are referred to as the darshanas or the schools of philosophy. And there are Sankhya is one of the philosophies, there's Vaisheshika, there's Mimamsa, there is the Nyaya school of philosophy, and each of these have their own approaches, how they study nature, how they study the nature of God, right? So each of these darshanas have their own viewpoints, especially about the nature of Prakriti and the nature of divinity and the relationship between the two. There are some philosophies that suggest that all Prakriti is one, and that Prakriti is distinct and different from Brahman. There are some schools that propagate that each entity has a soul, and that soul remains distinct from that of others. Meaning, my body has a soul, that soul is eternal, that goes from one body to the other, but that soul is different from your soul and the other souls around, and there is no merger, right? That's one approach to this philosophy. That is one philosophy. And there are other philosophies which say that an extension of this idea is every celestial object also has a soul. And in the case of celestial objects, we refer to these souls as deities, devatas or gods. So when you look at the sun is a physical entity, but there is a soul that is behind the sun, and that devata we refer to as Surya Deva or sun god, right? So there is a physical entity, but the subtle soul behind it is a deity. Similarly, you have Chandra Deva, you have a Lord Indra, who is behind rain and thunder. You have Agni Deva, who is behind fire. So this is again a concept. So each one has an Atma or a self. That self is distinct from everything else and distinct from Brahman. There are some Vedantic philosophies that believe that the individual does eventually merge in Parabrahman, but for that a process of purification is required. There are some philosophies, for instance, Advaita itself, which believe that there is no question of purification, one reaching the other and things like that, because you are not the body at all. You are already pure. You are already knowledge itself. There are some schools which say that Prakriti and Purusha can never merge. You do undergo this process of purification, but you reach a state where you become eternally a servitor of the Lord, right? Some of the Dvaita schools believe in that. So the idea is, when we say Vedanta, when we speak about the Vedas, all of these approaches, philosophies, Vedantas are there, and there are takers for all of them. There are people who have dedicated their lives to study, and these are all approaches. If we were to study philosophy in this manner, it's going to take many, many lifetimes even to understand each school of philosophy, right? So in that sense, all of these are prevalent in society. We are talking of a time when Krishna is delivering this discourse. All these Vedantic philosophies are available for the people. And people follow them based sometimes on their family lineage, which guru your great-grandfather has taken refuge in, and that philosophy is passed on generation-wise. So it is in the backdrop of this variety that Krishna is giving this discourse, right? It's very important to keep that in mind. For us, it may seem that this Krishna has already mentioned, you know, he has already told that the same Brahman is in each one. Why is he having to repeat it again? But truly speaking, if you look at it in this historical context, what Krishna is saying here, the statements that he's making here, are clarifications of some of the important truths, right? Because Krishna is an avatar, and the role that an avatar plays, a very important role every avatar plays, be it Krishna avatar or the avatar of our beloved Bhagwan, one of the important roles that an avatar plays is the clarification of some of these philosophies and ideas, right? There's a very beautiful verse that Swami sings about his avatar Wood, Yuga Dharma Paddhatul Vigalitamayunda. In that he says, Bhashyartha Gopyamul Veluguchununda. I might be quoting it wrong, I'm just recalling from memory. The meaning of that statement is where Swami says, I am here to clarify some of the truths hidden in some of these great commentaries and philosophies, right? So in that sense, what Krishna is saying here is very important, because these words that he is using, adhyatmika, adhyagnya, and so on, are all direct references to some of these philosophies and their approaches. I'm not going into that right now, but there are specific reasons why these words are being used. It would it'll take away too much of our time. Maybe going forward, if and where there is a context, I'll probably try to bring out those. But this is the context in which what Krishna is saying has also to be considered, right? It might not be necessary for our contemplation, but I'm just saying that that is the reason why some of these words are specifically being used in the Bhagavad Gita. So let us go back to the shloka now. Krishna starts with the first question. What is Brahman? And as you can see, the name of this chapter comes from these words that he says. He says, Aksharam Parama Brahmam. Brahman is Aksharam, means that which is beyond any degradation or which does not perish, as we just saw. Na Ksharati Iti Aksharam. That which does not decay is Aksharam. So the first description of Brahman that Krishna gives is that it is imperishable or immutable. The word Brahman itself has a very specific semantic meaning. Swami says that in Gita Vahini. Swami says Brahman comes from a root that means big, vast, right? That's why we say Brahmandam. That's a common word that we use in some of the Indian languages. Brahmandam means that which is magnificent and that which is grand, right? So the same root word is also used in Brahman, which means vast or large. So Swami says, how vast you may ask? Vaster than whatever you can call vast is the answer. So that which is akshara and vast. Krishna also uses the word paramam, param or paramam. In this statement, the word paramam or supreme can be added to Brahman or aksharam. Paramam Brahman is what we refer to as Parabrahman, means the supreme divine being. But in this case, in this statement, the word param is an adjective added to the word aksharam. Swami explains this in the Gita Vaini in this manner, and I quote, Brahman is not mere akshara, as you would have noticed. It is highest akshara, paramam akshara. What does that mean? It is the type of aksharam that is beyond the reach of time and space and knowability. It cannot be known by any or all the categories. It never declines or ends. It is the highest, indestructible, indescribable. End of quote. There is a reason why Brahman is specifically referred to as Paramam Aksharam. There are many elements that are Aksharam in this world as we interact with, but they are Aksharam only in comparison. For example, we refer to alphabets as Aksharas, right? In Sanskrit, the word for alphabets is Aksharas. Even in Hindi and few other languages, we use the word Aksharas means alphabets. When you take a statement, when there is a language, somebody is speaking something, when you break down that language, the last unbreakable unit is an alphabet, right? That's why we've given the name Akshara, that which cannot be broken any further. But it is not Paramam Aksharam, because even an alphabet can be broken down into phonetic sounds. And as we have seen, sound itself can be broken up into three or four categories, as we've seen Madhyama, Vaikhari, and Pashyanti, and all of that, right? So there can be a further breaking down. So in that say, for that reason, it is not Paramam Aksharam. Similarly, if you look at the relationship between clay and pots, our very favorite example that we often keep going back to, clay is compared Aksharam compared to the pot. Clay is considered aksharam compared to the pot. But clay also eventually undergoes change, right? In the larger time and space happening that goes on where the entire universe is undergoing a modification, right? So when you're talking about pots and clays, compared to the lifespan of a pot, clearly we can see that the clay is aksharam, because when the pot is broken down, it becomes clay, and this clay seems to have a longer period of existence compared to that name and form which we refer to as clay. But if you look at it from the point of view of the lifetime of the universe itself, even this clay undergoes modification. Same is the case with every physical entity, right? It may all finally come down to the five elements, right? When you have a human body, when you have a vehicle or an animal or a tree for that matter, when it finally decays and decomposes, you say that it comes down to the elements. And these elements are the panchabhutas. So compared to the things that exist in the world, the panchabhutas are aksharam. But compared to the panchabhutas, the tanmatras are spoken of as aksharam, as we have discussed even earlier. Before the process of panchikritam, they are tanmatras, where they are pure elemental form. So the tanmatras are aksharam compared to the panchabhutas. These tanmatras themselves become, I'm sorry, there's something else which is aksharam compared to these tanmatras too. And that is referred to as Brahman. That which can finally never be broken at all. It is the paramam aksharam. When you keep looking for that which is aksharam beyond all that we see and interact with, eventually you hit this paramam aksharam. That's why Brahman is very beautifully described as paramam aksharam. It is beyond all time and space. It is completely beyond everything that we can understand. That is why it is indescribable. At the same time, it is also spoken of as that which is indestructible. But this Brahman, as a saguna manifestation also, it is not purely nirguna, and that saguna manifestation is pranava. Om is called akshara Brahma. But that's a different topic and we'll come to that later. I just made a mention of that because even Gita Vahini at this point, Swami makes a mention of this. But we will be coming back to this. Om Akshara Brahma much later in the Gita too. So when we do that, we will speak about that. But for now, it is the description of Brahman as being Paramam Aksharam. The next line that Krishna makes is, Swabhavaha Adhyatmam Uchyate. We've already come across and studied this term Swabhava in the previous chapter itself. Swabhava of Brahman is Paraprakriti, or the supreme essence, right? We spoke of the Lord having a Swabhava and Swarupa. The Swarupa becomes the Aparaprakriti, or the manifest nature. The Swabhava is the Paraprakriti, or the unmanifest essence of the Supreme Lord. So here Krishna is saying, this Akshara Parabrahman's Swabhava is called Adhyatmam. What is this Adhyatma? It simply means the essential self. Every entity has a central core. Whether I believe I have a divine Atma or not, it is very easy to come to the understanding that I am not this body and mind, right? There is something more to me other than just this body and mind. And the simplest thing is every day and some aspect of our body is actually, we are letting go of that. When we have bath, so many of our cells get washed away. So many strands of hair keep falling off our head. We keep cutting our nails. A part of our body is going away. And something really more disastrous happens. And if there's an amputation, a part of your limb goes. But still you remain you. You do not change, right? Who you are remains you. So in this manner, when you, it calls for very simple self-introspection. It is very easy to understand that you're not this body, you're not this mind. But the other aspect of concluding that who you really are is divine, that's a different thing, and that calls for a little more contemplation. But here what Krishna is saying is that Adhyatma, what we're talking about is Adhyatma. When we say Adhyatmic literature, it means a study pertaining to the self, right? So something which is internal, when you start removing everything that is external and not part of who you really are, you are left with the Adhyatma, the core essence of every entity. So there is an Adhyatma to me, there is an Adhyatma to every entity in the universe. So the Adhyatma that Krishna is speaking about here means the idea of the self, or the concept of the self. Krishna has defined Brahman as Aksharam, Paramam, and then he is declaring that the true nature of that Brahman, its Swabhava, is the Adhyatma, or the nature of the self within all. As I said, for us it may seem like a repetition, but Krishna is setting the record straight by using specific terminology here. When you refer to something as Adhyatma, that is pertaining to the core self within. So Krishna is saying the Swabhava of that Brahman and the Adhyatma that is referred to in each being is one and the same. And this is an important declaration that Krishna is going to speak about, further. But I had so much more to say. We will pass that on to next week, because in this point, Swami very beautifully explains this one statement that Krishna is making, that the Swabhava is what the Akshara Brahman Swabhava is, the Adhyatmam that we are speaking about. The self within me and the Supreme Brahman is one and the same. How is that possible? Swami explains beautifully in the Gita Vaini. Probably next week we'll start with that explanation and then go further. This is only just the first line of the third verse, and then we'll take on the second line as well and take it on from there. So dear listeners, we'll conclude with that. I'm running out of time. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I thank you all for joining me this week. Do join me again next week at 10 a.m. for the resumption of the Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series. Till I meet you next time, keep safe, take care, Jai Sai Ram.